I will start momentarily.
I like the little goofy things that you like the little goofy moment you guys had before you started the last one. That was cool, by the
Yeah,
way.
maybe this will be that one for this episode. Welcome to Rated Gen X. I'm Gabe.
I'm Aaron.
And I'm Curtis.
And we're three ageless Gen X kids. And each week, we revisit the metaphorical multiplex of our minds
To watch an 80s film through a modern lens.
and see whether it holds up or if it is better overlooked. Get it?
Because of the Overlook
Yes.
Hotel. Sorry.
Thanks,
Oh,
Gabe. Oh, and Curtis didn't get it.
overlooked.
Yes.
Should we do that
The
again? Did I blow the
Overlook
joke?
Hotel.
All right,
Gabe,
bet. Yes.
that said, Gabe, remind us of what we're watching today.
Well, thanks for asking, Aaron. We're chopping through the door of room 237 to watch Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, 1980, starring Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, Scatman Crothers, and some creepy kids. This movie, wow. First of all, a few weeks
Yeah.
ago, we already talked about Batman. So Jack Nicholson has become the spiritual guide of our first foray into some movies. This is just a, it's an important film. I think it set the tone for horror, the wave of horror films that really broke out in the 1980s. And it's a terrifying film.
And based on the Stephen King novel, which of course, I mean, you can't have an 80s movie podcast without Stephen King. He
Right.
pretty much ruled the 80s. So
This movie scared
that's
the
kind of
crap out of me
essential.
before I even like was willing to watch it in like junior high school. I remember just like seeing trailers for it in the theater for other movies and a friend of mine telling me about it. Like I was like terrified of to watch it for years till I finally watched it in like junior high. And we were babysitting this kid across the street, this friend of mine and I, and the kid that we were babysitting looked and talked exactly like the kid in the movie, I remember. And I just ran all the way home after that.
I remember seeing the trailer too, but it was just the blood coming out of the
Yeah.
elevator. No scenes from the movie and the original teaser trailer. And I remember it scaring the shit out of me. Again, just with that image, it really left a mark.
I mean, I scared so easily. I mean, I would see a commercial for Friday the 13th or something, and I was like, I'm not sleeping for a week. It's over.
I think that when I think about just scary movies in general, from our generation, it really, they were something that you ended up watching a lot of times at sleepovers with friends. Like, generally didn't see them in theaters, as I recall, but it would be like, oh, so and so got Halloween, or so and so has Friday the 13th. And you'd watch the videos with your friends and be like, well, I'm not scared. I can watch that. I'm cool. Like, but you'd all kind of, it'd be like a dare to see who could actually watch the movie, not be too afraid. So it was like it was, but you did it as a group experience. And because it was on video, as opposed to being at a theater, you could kind of make fun of it or talk yourself out of being scared because you were in your friend group at a sleepover.
See, and I was the opposite. I just opted out. I had no desire to see scary movies, and I found a way out of it every time. I found an excuse not to do it. So I definitely didn't see this. I'm not even 100% sure that I watched it. It's one of those movies that I've seen so many clips of it that I'm not sure whether I've actually seen it in its entirety. But I know I didn't watch it as a kid. I know 100% I did not, because I did not watch. I just was like, nope, nobody, nope. So,
Aaron, you had the
you
same
know,
method of watching horror movies that I did for showering in the men's locker room, actually. That's what I used to do. I'll stop it out. It's not for me.
Gabe, you brought up an interesting point about the times because it was kind of like, for me, I'm like, it's like Russian roulette. Like, okay, we're having a sleepover at so-and-so's house. Like, crap. I hope to God he rented like the teen sex romp comedy. I could handle that, not the shit your pants slash your horror movie. And then it turned into like, oh, he's gonna rent one of each. So I'd be like, okay, I hope we can watch the like teen sex comedy afterwards so I can like sleep. But it was a whole like, oh yeah, I'm not scared. This is great, guys. This is amazing. Oh my God. So
And I literally
I
went home. I literally went home. I was like, I'm out. I'm going home, guys. I was
was
stubborn. I was stubborn. And like, I was like, I don't care. You can say what you want about me. I'm going home. If we're watching Friday the 13th, I'm going home. I
So you're
think I
just like,
left a couple of times.
nope,
Yeah. Yeah.
nope.
Just
Well, I remember I had a friend who was like, you know, he was reading Stephen King and Isaac Asimov and stuff. And I got into it too. And we were reading all that stuff, you know, and like he was reading that stuff when he was like 12. So he would tell me little bits about the book too. And I'm like, nope, terrified.
Well, before we watch The Shining, many people consider one of the scariest. And when Kubrick set out to make it, he said he was going to make the scariest horror film ever. So my burning question is, what movie or what scene from a movie scarred you for life? To this day, you cannot shake it.
Lots of choices, but I don't know.
Okay.
Does that include like that weird... Does this include that creepy animation from like Polar Express? Because that like that Uncanny Valley shit scares me, but I don't think
it... Maybe. It can be anything you want it to be. Anything you want it to be. But I don't want you to talk about it yet. We're not going there yet. Not yet, guys. Okay. So we're going to watch The Shining.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk scary movies after the break.
Can I ask you a question? Are you ready to channel your inner lumberjack? Then listen up, because we've got something sharp to talk about. Axes R Us, your one-stop shop for all things exciting. From chopping wood to blazing trails, our axes are built tough enough to handle whatever comes your way. Whether you're a seasoned outdoorsman or a troubled alcoholic writer, our axes are the perfect companion for your next adventure. But wait, there's more. With a wide selection of styles and sizes, you can find the perfect axe to suit your needs. Need to chop up a psychic chef? We've got you covered. Looking to chop down a bedroom door? Look no further. And hey, if you find yourself holed up in a remote hideaway, just remember, when life gives you lemons, grab an axe, and we'll chop your way to a solution. Axes R Us today, and get ready to unleash your inner lumberjack, because when it comes to chopping wood and taking names, nobody does it better than Axes R Us. Let's accentuate the positive.
Okay, so we're back. Before we dig in or dig out of The Shining, let's talk about the movies that scarred us for life, or the movie scene that scarred us for life. So who wants to go first?
I got a couple that I thought of, and I don't know if there's a ranking on this, if there's just one. The first movie that just, I'd never had this experience in a movie theater before was watching Blair Witch when it first came out, and having seen it at Sundance like a braggart, but seeing it in the original first time it's being shown to an audience, and just the hype and buzz around it was tremendous. But it was the first found footage type movie, and there was just a palpable energy, and you were on the edge of your seat the entire time because you did not know what was about to happen next. I think it got hyped and then people got disappointed with it later, but I just remember being terrified of certain scenes in that movie. It's like the less you saw, the more scary it got. Like when they unwrapped the teeth, there was a scene where they just find teeth, and it was just that the teeth was what really got me. The second is a movie called It Follows, which is just about these creatures who follow, like they inhabit people, nobody else can see them, and they just walk right towards you in broad daylight and infect you, and then you get the infection, and then it's terrifying. And so that was another one that, because it happens in broad daylight, but the way the film is shot is every now and then there's just a character who's beelining right towards the people, sort of with no rhyme or reason, and there's something really uncanny about it that is spooky. The movie Midsommar is another scary movie that takes place in broad daylight. And there's something about movies that are scary, but in the light, that it really scares me. And I think that one is another one that did that. And then the fourth one.
And oh, this my is God.
I know, I have four, because these are like, that made a difference
to me. And you keep doing it. You're just keep inflicting.
I'm going to keep inflicting the pain. The movie Scream, the opening sequence, the first Scream, the opening sequence with Drew Barrymore, is so terrifying, and it is one of the most perfect sequences in the history of cinema. And the scariest part of it, and again, I say this now as a parent, is when her parents are coming home and they get home just 2 minutes too late to like just witness her bleeding out. And it's so heartbreaking, and everything about it is devastating. Sorry, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't seen the movie. But that scene, I watched it recently, and I was like, I was just on the edge of my seat, shuddering. Like, it was terrifying. So those are the terrifying images. I hope you sleep well tonight, y'all.
Do you remember, Gabe? I actually asked you, because again, I'm not like I just opt out of horror movies. I've seen very few. And do you remember me asking you about Midsommar and being like, and trying and being like, I'm interested. Should I see it? Should I watch it? And you were like, no, you don't want to see it. You're like, you won't be able to handle it. Don't do
Don't do it. So terrifying.
it,
It is. It's
Aaron.
the most recent film
And I
of
still
that.
haven't. I'm not watching it. Let's go ahead, Curtis.
Well, this kind of opens me up to my Hollywood insider bit, but so I'm talking about movies that scared the shit out of me. I saw The Exorcist when I was 12 years old, living by my, well, not by myself, with no friends or anyone around in an apartment in Philadelphia filled with retired people. My mom and I watched The Exorcist, the edited for television version on the black and white TV we had, and I was terrified for the entire rest of the summer, and I had to sleep on my parents' floor. I'll admit it. I'll admit it. And like the freakiest things for me, and this kind of relates to The Shining, are like, I don't know if you remember this in The Exorcist, but they'd show like a flash of the demon's face for like not even a second. And it's that
Right.
whole kind of like, and they do that a lot in movies now, where it's like be like, oh, there's someone on the ceiling crawling backwards for a second or something like that. And it's that
Right.
whole, what really messes me up is like, I know it's in the movie, but you feel like you're the only one that saw it, which makes it like you just start sweating and freaking out. You know what I mean? The whole th and I'm like Aaron, like I avoided horror movies like The Plague, and I still kind of do, but my daughter has been like, oh, can we watch this movie? Can we watch that movie? Like, she had a sleepover. Like, can we watch this movie? Can we watch Seven? I'm like, no. Can we watch The Exorcist? I'm like, yeah, sure. And next day, I'm like, how was The Exorcist? She was like, it was stupid. I'm like, oh my God. So
Oh,
now I
wow.
feel like I'm sort of realizing that the horror movie thing, it's sort of adjacent to the sci-fi fantasy thing, right? So there's some horror movies and scary movies that are just like good movies as opposed to like shit your pants crazy. But I'm realizing it's the same kind of adrenaline rush you get when you're like on a roller coaster. It's like terrifying, but you had a good time, right?
Yeah.
We watched this movie, I think it's called Hereditary. Have you guys seen this? 30 seconds in, with just the music playing and the credits, my wife's like, I'm out. And then my son
Really?
and my daughter and I, like, we watched the whole thing through, and I'm like trying to, there's a few parts in that movie. I'm like sweating from
Really?
the suspense. Oh yeah. But I just kind of grinned and bear it. And then my daughter, who's like tough, like I can handle anything, like she was like messed up from that for like a good like month. In fact, we'd do little things from the movie to mess with each other, and she would get like really upset. But I was like, I wasn't gonna admit it, like I was still scared from it too. But that's, you know, it did the trick. It scared the crap out of you and gave you this like adrenaline rush. But you
Here's how it goes, and this it's probably all goes back to this, which and it's Stephen King, of course. It's all Stephen's fault. It's all Stephen's fault. And this is even before, this was pre-80s. I was in elementary school and I had an irresponsible babysitter who let me watch the television miniseries for Salem's Lot. It wasn't even
Oh.
a it was yeah, the television miniseries for Salem's Lot. And there's a scene in that miniseries where there's a vampire kid who floats up to a second story window and he's scratching on the glass, and it scarred me for life to the point where in I got God, it was like 2008 or 2009, we were house shopping in Park City, Utah. And these are ski homes, and the way they're built is, you know, it's all about the views. So the whole backside of the house will be just nonstop windows. You really can't put window coverings on these windows. There are too many windows. They're too high up, whatever. You leave them uncovered. That's just how it goes. And every single house, I'm thinking, there are going to be vampires on the window. What am I going to do? And And of course, I can't tell the real estate agent this because she'll just think I'm crazy. But I did end up getting a house and didn't put window coverings, didn't put curtains on my windows, and no vampires showed up. But I mean, literally, yeah, it really scarred me for life. I'm
I
still
remember
very
that.
much, I went back and watched it again and found the scene just to see, and it's still scary. It's still, and I'm still very much about once, as soon as it gets dark, close those blinds because you just don't know when that vampire is going to show up on that window. So let's talk about The Shining.
Terrifying.
Bomb,
bomb,
So,
bomb.
revisiting it, it's scarier, obviously, when you're by yourself. In this case, sometimes horror movies are actually scarier with an audience because you get the suspense and you hear other people screaming and it kind of builds. In this case, I think there's something about being isolated watching this movie that resonates and makes it scarier because the movie is about being isolated. And again, I think, and not to say your experience is going to be worse, Aaron, than Curtis's and mine, but there is something that speaks to a man of a certain age who feels responsibility for his family and so forth, that I think there's just something in this story and about, being a stifled artist and not being able to create that's there. And then the other things that really stood out to me most recently, and again, this is something that when I was younger, the horror part stood out, right? This the idea that the Overlook is a haunted space and that there's mystical powers inside of there and there's this sort of cycle of murder and death and all that. This time I really keyed into the idea of the Jack Torrance character himself being an abusive person. And they hint at it a number of times. They lay the story out pretty early on that he is an abusive father. And he denies it and says it was an
Alcoholic.
accident and so forth. And it's the alcoholism that feeds into it, but it's not only the alcoholism, right? He uses that as an excuse. Wendy uses that as an excuse, and then he doesn't touch alcohol anymore. Now he's fine. But it's this really remarkable sense that she's walking on pins and needles on all the time from the jump. And you get that sense that everything she does as an abused spouse is trying to protect her child who was also suffering the abuse. And so that's the part that really resonated with me this time, is how it's really a critique of that as much as anything. And so the trappings of the story, I think, are meant to lead you to this conclusion. So the mystical stuff does exist in the film. There are a few things that wouldn't happen without the mysticism, but I think if you peel away the layers, the what remains is that story of a broken man who is an abusive person, and it breaks your heart a little bit to watch it, and particularly to see how Danny and his mother, Wendy, are trying to deal with this and survive it and get through this window. And this, even like, you can view the whole thing metaphorically, right? This whole isolation is just a metaphor for what it's like to be in that situation. So that's what really stuck with me this time. There's a million things to talk about, but I want to get your guys' immediate impressions as well.
So I didn't find the movie scary at all.
Look
Not in the least. I didn't
at you
find it.
go.
I thought it
I'm so
was so.
brave, Aaron. Good for
And
you.
now I'm wondering if all these years I've just hyped myself up so much and none of these movies are actually scary because I'm watching a thing, I'm like, what's scary? Like what? And honestly, yeah, I did realize like, wow, I've never seen this from beginning to end. I've only seen so many clips of it that I thought I might have, and I wasn't sure, but watching beginning to end, I didn't find it scary. I was really disappointed because you have these iconic clips, these scenes that are so good, and you have this cast, and you have this Overlook Hotel, which is actually the exterior shots. There was a hotel in Oregon, and then they have this beautiful sound stage, which was amazing. The interior shots and just the scenery shots. You have this cast. You have all these different things, and he had all these tools to make something really awesome. And I just felt like from beginning to end, it just kind of didn't make sense, and it was kind of just messy. And I didn't find it scary. I found it just, I don't know. Confusing. I didn't like it. And the other, well, Stephen King didn't like it either, I found out. So I'm team Stephen. Yeah. What did you think, Curtis?
I don't know. I guess the kids saw that, it's one of those movies that's on TV kind of frequently, like, oh, let's jump into it, watch it. So they've seen it and they like it, but they'll be like, I remember a snow day a couple years ago. It was like a 3 day long snow day, and I, like, without intending to, was kind of Jack Nicholson'd up, and it's like, you're like the Here's Johnny guy, daddy. I'm like, what? Oh God, I'm sorry.
Oh,
And then I turn
God.
around like, I'm not gonna hurt you, I'm just gonna bash your brains in. You're like, ah, do it again, chase me. Like, okay, let's play The Shining. But I don't know. I mean, it wasn't definitely wasn't as scary, but I'll tell you what, when I put it on to watch it, for the purposes of the show, the very beginning when it comes in with that bomb, bomb, that bombastic music, like, really grabbed me and put me in the place of the movie and carried me through. And it was like you're hearing an
Are
organ.
you talking about when they're driving up
I'm talking
the
about the
like that
very
early,
beginning of the
or
movie.
like, well, at the
Yes.
very beginning they're driving up the beautiful shot where they're
Yeah,
driving
it's
in
a
the
beautiful
car up
shot.
the,
It's like a beautiful shot, but which is, like you just said, it's a beautiful shot juxtaposed against this sort of
I did like
demonic,
that.
it sounds like an organ being played in the Upside Down from Stranger Things, like with pipes made from the flesh of tortured souls. It's just like brilliant. It's very similar to the Clockwork Orange
Yeah, it's the same
soundtrack.
composer named Wendy Carlos, and she's
Yeah.
brilliant.
I think, it wasn't scary, but I enjoy it. And it was interesting because, Aaron, you said like the confusingness took you out of it. But I remember when I think the confusingness, especially in terms of when I first saw it, how it hit me, is what made it
Even
scary. Because it's like, what the
Disorientation.
fuck is
Let's say
going on?
different
Yeah,
confusingness.
the
Let's make it a
disorienting
word. We're
thing is a
making that a
thing.
word, the confusingness. Go ahead.
The
That's
confusingness.
the
Like,
name. That
what's,
was
and
the
I remember
subtitle.
being like, it's, but it's the same thing, like I was saying earlier with The Exorcist or Hereditary, with like quick flashes of stuff. The things that were most terrifying for me were the confusing things, especially like when Wendy's running around and like, what are those two guys doing in the hotel room? Like that messed me up forever. Like, now that I'm older, like, oh. But I've also read the book, and I've also, and Stephen King, like you said, like, he never liked the movie. And then he did that miniseries with Steven Weber, but the book re you know it is but I think overall The Shining still
You're
stands
the
up.
only one. You're the only one of us three who's read the book, right? I think.
I
I
don't
have
know.
not. Yeah,
Has
Gabe, you
have
have
you
not read the book.
what's a
Gabe.
book? If you read the book, in the epilogue of the book, you find out who Tony is. It's pretty cool. And I've read Doctor
Oh.
Sleep and the sequel to it, which is Danny grown up and all that. But
Yeah. Okay. So
but
now
my
I have a
overall
question for
impression
you.
is the movie's great, and I think it still holds up. It's almost like it's an art house movie, but I think it stands among the pantheon of the classic horror movies that aren't necessarily scary. Like, we're not scared shitless when we watch Frankenstein again or something like that, but I think it's right up there.
Yeah, I
Okay.
would argue, and again, I actually agree with you on that point, Curtis. I think it first and foremost, it's a Stanley Kubrick film, and his films are extremely stylized. But to the point, to Aaron's point, to your point about the disorientation, or what was the word we came up with, confusedness.
Confusingness. Confusingness.
The confusingness. I would argue that it's deliberate. There's a
Yes.
lot written about this movie. It's been dissected and deconstructed a million times. I highly recommend anybody who wants to take a deeper dive into this, is there's a documentary called Room 237, which is amazing, and it goes into different fan theories and so forth. The
I've seen that.
disorientation in the film, I think, is deliberate. In other words, there's a sense at one point, right? You have the maze, which, by the way, is not in the novel. It's completely a construction of Stanley Kubrick, right? The maze. So he's invented this maze as the central metaphor of the story. There's a scene where Jack is overlooking the maze and he sees Wendy and Danny in it, even though there's no way he can see them. And you cut to them actually in it. So there's this weird back and forth. But what somebody's pointed out is that if you look at the geography, not just of the maze itself, but of the floor plan of the Overlook Hotel based on what you get inside, that it doesn't make sense. The logic of the building is disorienting. So the best example is the very first scene where he goes into the office to be interviewed, and it's the scene later on where they have it's where the intercom system is, where they can communicate with the park ranger. There's a window in that room, right? That looks like it looks outside. But that room is completely in the center of the building. There's no way that room is located with an exterior window. So he's created a room inside of a space that looks like it looks out to an exterior space, but it doesn't. There's scenes where the logic of where the doors are placed, where that we get inside room 237, the geography of that room is different internally than what it would be externally. And for somebody like Kubrick, who's a perfectionist and who does everything for a reason, it's you can't just say, well, it's because the set design didn't work. It's like, no, he makes choices very specifically and very deliberately. He wants you the whole time to just your brain to be a little confused or a little
Well,
upset.
yeah, you've made
I
your
posit
point.
this.
I think I would love to get to the point in my job where I can just fuck things up and make things really confusing and people are like, well, she's just a genius. I would love that. But that's not, I mean, I
Kubrick
don't
for you.
know. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's the thing. We get into this thing where it's like, it's Kubrick. You just have to, and it's just kind of annoys me because I just feel like, I don't know. But
I proffer that that maybe may whether it's deliberate or not, it does give you the subconscious feeling that the hotel itself as a structure is alive and can kind of change its shape and fuck with you.
Doc or Chef at one
Right.
point suggests that, right? That the
And if
building has.
Kubrick, who I heard there was this long shot, I don't know if Gabe, but you would know better than me, but I remember there was a long, he was infamous for doing take after take after take, and there was a shot of no dialogue of just Jack Nicholson walking through the hotel, and they did like fucking 100 takes. And I've watched a documentary about Kubrick and the guy who gave up his acting career to be his right-hand man. I mean, the guy was obsessive compulsive. I can't imagine any other filmmaker that was cuckoo over details like Kubrick. So I
Right.
don't know.
Well, but the thing about people who are obsessive compulsive, and yeah, there's like one scene where he does 127 takes. That's the one where they're going up the stairs. Shelley Duvall has the bat
Oh.
and Jack Nicholson. So the thing about people who get obsessive is they tend to focus on all the wrong things. They aren't necessarily focusing on. So to I don't yeah, and it really felt when I was watching, it really felt to me like someone who had gotten to the point where they were going to do things the way they were going to do them. And there was a lot of ego involved, and no one could tell them otherwise. And there weren't, nobody was going to be able to tell them, hey, this doesn't really make sense, or this doesn't really work, or this doesn't. And they were just going to, and if they wanted to focus on 128 takes for this, people were just going to let them do it, even when it made no sense whatsoever. And that's what it felt like to me. It really felt like you'd gotten, I don't know. It just felt like, and there was very little consideration of, okay, is the audience going to understand this? Does this make sense? Is this cohesive? That's an expectation I have when I watch movies, and I just didn't feel it with this. I mean, I know this is not a popular opinion for the people who love Kubrick, but
I understand he's a perfectionist. That doesn't excuse him from being what I would consider a tyrant. I don't think being a perfectionist allows you or gives you free rein to torture your performers. And I would argue that Kubrick was exacting with his precision of what he wanted, but with performers, he especially wanted to break them. And there's a lot said about the Shelley Duvall character in particular, and there's been subsequent stories written about this and so forth that she was tormented. This actually broke her as a person. Like this production really was damaging to her psychologically and possibly to her career. She, in the immediate aftermath, would talk about what a genius he was, but later in later times talked about how she was her hair was falling out, she was losing sleep and so forth, and it was had to do with a number of takes he had her doing. He had her running around for hours and hours and hours, screaming and so forth. And the same
just like
thing
a typical
happened.
acting class, really.
It is it's just like you every
Oh,
day. It's a
I've
similar
seen things.
story. You hear similar stories like this about the production of Eyes Wide Shut, right? That it might have messed with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman's marriage, that they had to do so many scenes repeatedly. And it's been argued that he over-exercised his power. He had them literally like have to cancel other movies and so forth to stay on set as long as they did. So I agree with that aspect of things. I think being a perfectionist doesn't give you carte blanche to treat your actors poorly. I do respect the final result. I just don't like how he got it. And I wish there's a way to reconcile that. Sometimes the art stands alone, but in some
I wonder sometimes if she was like welcoming to have that happen. 'Cause I've done some parts and stuff here and there, like playing a heroin addict. Like you put yourself through all certain sort of things and want that to get to a certain performance level. But it was so hard to watch the way he treated her, man. Like, but I don't know what the full context was, but God.
I mean, there's similar stories about Hitchcock, right, on the set with Behedron and so forth. It's not uncommon for this dynamic to play out, particularly in horror movies, strangely, because you torment your actress to make her get the most dramatic performance possible. But in this case, the stories are that Nicholson was never treated with the same level of having to ter be terrorized. In other words, he was always treated differently, and so it's a very common trope to have actresses get worked up and have the director sort of pull tricks to do that type of thing. The
Yeah,
other
instead of just let them act because they're actors and that's what they do. So maybe just let them act and not have to, put
you
them
know the
feel like
famous
you have to
story
do
with
this, create this situation.
Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier when they're doing the marathon, man.
No.
Dustin Hoffman like stayed up for 3 nights and starved himself to try and get into the method of it and da da da. And he's talking to Laurence Olivier. He's like, "So what'd you do to prepare for the scene?" And da da da. And he's like, "Why don't you just try acting?
And there
Just
you have it.
try acting instead of, you know." But
It's
so
because that's the
method
situation.
versus
being classically trained.
It's at the end of the well. There's classically trained. There's Meisner method. I mean, I don't want to get into the history of acting training, but yeah. But
Well, and
Stanislavski, when he
it's
saw
something
what
that
Strasberg was doing with method, he's like, "You are you crazy? You know, why do you have to?" And the whole thing with method is you get so caught up in whipping yourself into a certain state that you ignore everything else that's going on around you, as opposed to reacting to what's going on as if it's real.
The other thing is that it really annoyed me that Jack Nicholson's character from the very get-go was so weird and sinister, because I prefer my descents into madness to be gradual. I like it when people show up and they seem very normal and things are cool and there's something, but it's not so. And from the get-go, when he's sitting and being interviewed, you're like, this guy's a psychopath. Like he just had that. And I didn't that part, and it made and it just made him feel very one-dimensional to me, like not very complex.
He had always had that slight eccentricity. What I love about it is that they're all treating him like he's normal, but you can already see that he's not. Like, to me, that's the, again, it may excuse it, but it's the sense of you're a perfect candidate. By all means, come on up here. And then they tell him the story about the guy who chopped up his family. And he's like, "Wow, that's quite a story." And they're
My
like,
wife will be
"Come on
interested
back, you'll be fine." And then later he admits to, "I felt like I've been here before. I've had this uncanny sense that I've always lived here. I knew what was happening next." I think the tell for us as an audience is we can already see his descent happening from the get-go. He's already there. The building is going to unlock it in him. And he's already proven himself to be abusive and so forth. So the family's already on edge around him. So I think your sensing is it exactly right, but the rest of the world doesn't see it. Only we see it as an audience.
She says like, well, it's been 5 months. Like, oh, and Danny this, and ever since then he hasn't had a drink for 5 months, right? And you noticed her cigarette ash is like massive, and there's no way they didn't do that on purpose. But to me, as like the English professor analysis, like this is foreshadowing that things in nature are out of whack. You know, something is afoot at the Circle K. You know,
Right.
something strange in Denmark, et cetera, et cetera. It's an allegory for the demonism of alcoholism, right?
Yeah,
And
I
if
think
you
that's
think
right.
about that way, he's a sympathetic character. And of course, he's probably on edge. He's probably like on a 5 month long dry drunken withdrawal. And I think that's what happens to him in the hotel, is he has a cuckoo, regardless of however supernatural it was. he has a drink at the bar, and then shit starts to happen. You know what I
Right.
mean? But the
But
book, that's the whole thing that Stephen King was upset about, because he wrote it as a allegory for the hell of
exactly.
alcoholism. Right.
Exactly. That's what I read. Yeah, he expected he and he was disappointed that that didn't feature more. And actually, you know, it's interesting, Curtis, because you're doing a really like good job of pairing the two together and kind of letting one fill in for the other. But from what I understand, Kubrick really completely wanted nothing to do with the book. I mean, he basically just needed a basic premise. He wanted to do a horror film, needed a basic premise, and you know, found and was reading several books, and every time he didn't like one, he would throw it against the wall, and then came across The Shining. Okay, I can work with this. Didn't even read the script that Stephen King had already written, because he had the book, and then he wrote a screenplay for it as well. Just completely disregarded it. So he really he you're pulling the book in a way that he never did. You
Fine.
know,
But
he
when
that
you
he
adapt,
I was never willing to do, which is
yeah,
kind of interesting.
when
That's
you
because I'm a
adapt,
fucking genius. All
but when you
right.
adapt, you have to, I mean, this is the difference, right? This is the difference between a novel and a film. I think Kubrick made choices, obviously, and it's his prerogative as the director and the person who adapted the story. I think what Stephen King learned was early in his career, hey, guess what? When you sell your work to Hollywood, if you don't keep more control over it, you lose that control. So that was his lesson, which is fine.
Yes.
He has been involved in some great adaptations. He's been involved in some disastrous adaptations that he was in charge of. He's directed a couple movies. I mean, I think Stephen King is a great novelist and a great writer. I don't know if I would trust his film acumen over Kubrick's. And I'm not saying that as a Kubrick fanboy. I'm just saying that as, like, I think Kubrick's choices work for cinema in a way that just certain things are not going to work for a novel. The work from a novel are not going to adapt to a screen. I do think the alcoholism theme remains. Like, I feel like it's there. It's just not the only thing, right? He talks about being on the wagon, and he says literally 5 months on the wagon and the irreparable harm, it's done, right? And he says at one point, my soul for a glass of beer, which literally is what happens, right? He starts drinking again in the magical world because they already made clear there's no alcohol in the building, so something is filling his soul, and now he is possessed by that power of, the metaphor of alcoholism is there. But I also think Kubrick probably added a bit more about the struggle of being a blocked artist as well, and leaned heavily on that. But those two things together combined to his abuse. Like, he's just an abusive asshole. And to me, the most interesting sequence in the film is the one in which he has the dream, right? And he's vulnerable. It's the last time that he's a genuinely vulnerable person. He wakes up from the dream and he says, I had this horrible dream that I cut you and Danny up to little pieces. And he's crying and he's legitimately afraid, right? He's not possessed at that point, and he's 100% vulnerable. And then Danny walks in, having been to room 237, and he's been abused. Like, you can see the mark on his neck. Now, the easy thing for Nicholson to do, because then she's like, you abused him. And he's like, no. And then he goes to the room, sees the quote unquote ghost who abused him, and then denies the ghost existed. So now you're in this weird place, like, he did abuse him. He knows he abused him. He knows there was no ghost in the room. He's the guy who fucking abused his child. And I think that if you read it literally, that's what happened. I don't know metaphorically how it's supposed to play out, but I feel to me like his alcoholism is tied directly to that. And that one moment of vulnerability he has is the last true sense of him being just a normal person and having remorse and having regret. But from that point on, he's gone. Like, he
He's
never comes back.
blacked out, in other words.
And from that point on, you get like the Kubrick stare, right? That thing where he's looking over his eyelids. Like, that's it. From that point on, he's done. And that's when he's going to take the bat and get the axe, and everybody's going to die.
Danny!
One other thing I wanted to just address was the Scatman Crothers character. I think he's both heroic but underused, and there's like a bit of tragedy to this as well, the way it plays out. And I'm just curious what your guys' thoughts on this was. I mean, he's a classic, quote unquote, magical Negro character who Stephen King has this real affinity for these characters. He's mystical. He seems as though he's going to be heroic, but his death is probably the most tragic of all. But what do y'all think about the way he appears in the film, his journey? Did anything strike you about that character?
In the book, it's a completely different ending, and he actually figures a lot more prominently in the
Yeah, he
book,
does.
from what I
Yeah.
understand.
To me, the way Kubrick took that, it was like, and I'm trying to remember the, because you're thinking, oh God, help is on the way, and they're trapped, and he's on the way, and he's the guy that can save the day, and da 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 da. And then to have him pretty much get taken out immediately is profound. After all the shit of getting up there ends up having no effect on helping them.
Well, and if he hadn't shown up, they wouldn't have the snow cat to leave at the end. So the real question
Absolutely,
is
yeah.
this: does he, because he has visions, right? He knows. I my theory is he knows he's gonna die. Like, I think he knows he has to know, but he also has to know that if he doesn't get up there, Wendy and Danny are like,
When he's in, when he's at his place and they show Scatman Carruthers and he's like this, like staring off in the face, safe. He's got this terrified look on his face. That was the shot from the trailer that I saw in the kid that when I was a kid that just like haunted me for like years and years and years, was
Oh,
that shot
really?
in his face. Yeah. I
Yeah,
remembered that. I was like, oh,
that one
that's
and
what
the
happened.
one, there's a few shots of Danny having the same thing. Like, to me, the shots of them being terrified is scarier than what they see when they're
Less
terrified.
is more. Less is more in this movie. That's definitely
The
why.
twin girls, though, creepy as fuck. That image is terrifying. It's inspired, for those who don't know, by a Diane, famous Diane Arbus photograph, but just the girls holding hands and then seeing them chopped up in the hallway briefly through those quick cuts, that's terrifying. But yeah, the Scatman Crothers, I mean, I love that character so much because he calls Danny Doc. You start hearing his voice in his head. I like that whole sequence
So
is
sweet and
amazing.
nurturing too.
And I do agree with you, Curtis. Like, the thing at the when he dies is so tragic. It felt like Kubrick was doing a Hitchcock homage right there. Like, to me, that felt like a little bit like a Psycho homage, where you get really invested in a
Oh
character's story
yeah.
and then you just kill them off, and then you've left with nothing. Because he's really meant to be the hero. He's meant to be the one who saves them. And then when he gets killed, you're like, oh man, like they're screwed. Like, they're in trouble now.
I'm completely underwhelmed by this movie, and I'm realizing that maybe I avoided horror movies all these years just because
For nothing,
I
yeah.
would, yeah, I'm just, I don't know,
He built it up
this
tough.
I'm
Transcends
too
the
tough for
genre.
them.
I think The Shining is kind of like the Metallica of horror movies because it's sort of like everyone can like it, whether they're a horror movie person or not. You know, like it's
Except
sort of, I
Aaron.
think it
Except
stands on
Aaron.
its own as like a, just a movie that's classic.
Well, it sounds to me like we're getting
Do
ready to
the
jump in with our big Gen X ratings. So, coming up, we're going to give The Shining our official Gen X rating.
Okay, well, we will be back.
All work and no play making you a dull boy? Tired of staring at a blank page and feeling like your creativity is spent? Help is on the way. Introducing Writer's Block Workshop, your sanctuary for inspiration. Break through your mental barrier and unleash your creativity like never before. Led by experienced writing coaches, our workshops are designed to help you chop through your writer's block and reignite your passion for writing. Whether you're a seasoned novelist, a budding poet, or someone who loves to write, our workshop is open to writers of all levels and genres. But that's not all. In addition to our writing workshops, you'll also learn how to type on an old-school typewriter, the clacking clickety type. So don't let writer's block hold you back any longer. Join us at the Writer's Block Workshop and rediscover the joy of writing. Your next masterpiece is just waiting to be unleashed.
Welcome back to Rated Gen X. Now's the time where we rate the movie. Aaron, you get to go first today.
Oh, yay. Okay. Well, all right. I'm going to do a scale. I'm going to do a scale of 1 to 127. which is the number of takes that he
Ah.
took, that Kubrick took, required Shelley Duvall to do that. It actually, that scene where they're going up the stairs is actually an excellent scene. Don't think it required. I hate saying that because then it's like, see, it needed 127. No, it didn't fucking need 127 takes, but it was a good scene. Anyway, yeah. Okay. And I'm gonna give it out of 1 to 127, which 127 being the best, I'm gonna give it a 62.342, since we're being very precise and exact. There you have it. I have no fucking idea what that means, but that's okay because I have no fucking idea what this movie meant. Go for it, guys.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
What do you got,
I'm
Kevin?
salty. It's early here.
I don't think
Go
I
for it.
agree with you, Wendy. I think this fucking movie stands on its own. There's nothing else like it. It was the grandfather of movies that come before. It's my job to be the fanboy apologist. So I'm gonna give it 5 out of 5 big wheels.
I
So
want to
it's like a pink,
analyze your
it's a
scale.
pink
I want to
one.
analyze your rating scale to the level that you guys analyze this movie
You
to
can do
overthink
that.
your
There's going to be a
ratings.
documentary.
Oh,
It's going to be called Room
yes.
127
One,
Rating.
two.
Right.
So I'm going to give this one 5 Tonys. Thank you. 5 out of 5 Tonys. I think the
Nice.
movie definitely has its issues. I especially think that Kubrick's treatment of women is never good, never favorable. His issues around sexuality, the WTF moment late in the film where the furry is giving the guy a blowjob in the room is the weirdest thing I think I've ever seen. I don't know why it's in there, but I still think the movie is meant to be disturbing, and that did disturb me. So again, 5 out of 5 Tonys. This could go to somebody's EGOT because I put a Tony in there. So somebody's going to get an EGOT as a result.
There you have it. How can you give 5 out of 5 when you say there are issues? How can you do
Because,
that though? Can
well,
you,
there's
it
a
would
difference
be.
between what the background information of the artistry that went into it and then the work itself. So if you bifurcate
Okay.
those two, like it's sort of like, well, I don't like those homophobic people that make that chicken sandwich, but I like the chicken sandwich.
So now that we've wrapped up The Shining, we've got another movie coming up, and I'm
We
really
do.
curious what we got. It looks like it's Aaron's choice.
Yeah, what do you
Thank
got, man?
God. Thank fucking
Yeah,
God.
thank God. Let's get out of this hotel
Thank
shit.
God it's my choice. Heathers.
Ooh. Right.
Yes.
Heathers, 1989.
Oh.
Good choice.
Yes.
What's your
Yep.
damage?
1989. What's your damage? I love,
Yeah.
yeah, I love
I don't
that.
know.
So Daniel Waters, he wrote this when he was 20, only 23 years old, and he is a huge fan of Dr. Strangelove, which is a Kubrick film, and he wrote it because he wanted Kubrick to direct this movie. The way he saw it is Kubrick had done a science fiction film, he'd done a war film, a period film, and a horror film, and he was like, okay, his next thing needs to be a teen film. Kubrick needs to do a teen film, and I'm going to write it. And that's what he wanted. And he tried and tried and tried to get the screenplay in front of Kubrick, did not succeed. And then it ended up in Michael Lehman's hands. But yeah, it's kind of funny. That's who he wanted to direct the movie. He wrote it specifically for Kubrick. So interestingly
Kubrick
enough,
teen
and
movie. Now that
I'm
would be
so glad that
isn't that
it did
amazing?
come.
I love that. That's one of the greatest
I
stories ever.
know. Isn't that funny? I know.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
Yeah, me
let's
too.
save the rest
In a
for
while.
next
Let's
broadcast.
save the rest.
Yes.
It's going to be great.
Okay.
Thing. All right, y'all. I can't wait.
Me neither. All right.
Me neither.
We still
Yeah.
need we need to end on our new catchphrase, which is it's so very.
Greater Gen X is written, performed, and produced by Gabe Wardell, Erin O'Reilly, and Curtis Eames. Post-production by Gabe Wardell. Theme song and other musical cues by Ryan Thomas Johnson. If you like Greater Gen X, give us a rating. Don't like something we said, or have an idea for a movie we should do? Come and play with us on social media. Find us on Instagram and TikTok and YouTube forever and ever and ever. Or if you still use an old-fashioned typewriter, send an email to hello@ratedgenxpod.com. To listen to Gabe's bloody mixtape inspired by The Shining, visit the show notes on ratedgenxpod.com or find the link on Instagram. Thank you for listening to Rated Gen X. This hereby concludes our broadcasting day.
That's why my daughter was saying that. They were trying to do fetch, and I was like, where does that come from? That's stupid. That's Mean Girls, right?